My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here this morning. I'm glad to be sober. I want to thank the women and men in charge for inviting me and showing hospitality and graciousness. That's always nice when you hang out with a bunch of drunks who were sober. So thank you a lot for that. I think this is the first sober thing I've ever done in Bakersfield. And I'm glad that I'm sober for it. You know, I lived in Los Angeles for a long time. I've lived up in Oakland for over 20 years. I've got a brother who lives near Fresno. I have a little bit of familiarity with California, and I find that wherever I travel, people do things a little different. I got sober in Berkeley in 1976, and the speaker last night made reference to this, but this is the law. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you travel anywhere, even across town, it's always a surprise how these people who are doing it wrong manage to stay sober. I mean, it's always a big shock. And I got sober in smoking AA. We all smoked our heads off. I got sober in depressed AA. We were all depressed. And I got sober in non-clapping AA. We didn't clap for anything. We just kind of sat there and complained. And after I was sober about a year, I moved to Los Angeles to go back to work at Loyola High School in Los Angeles, and boy, things were different. They had greeters at the door and happy, perky people, glad to see ya, and well-lit rooms, and I just went into shock. I didn't know how any of these people stayed sober. They were so enthusiastic. I'm going to talk about my own stuff. One of the traditions we just read says we stay away from outside controversial issues. One of the problems I have is I have opinions on everything, and I hope none of them bleed into anything I have to say. And if they do, just be tolerant and realize that everyone has odd points of view. But it's what it was like and what happened and what it's like now in my particular framework. I'm 57 years old. I was born in San Jose, California. I'm from a home where we had active alcoholism, but pretty much functional alcoholism. We went to work and participated in a lot of things, and half of the family was Irish, Catholic, and Democratic, and we didn't call them alcoholics, we called them characters. And the other half of the family was Swedish, Lutheran, and Republican, and we didn't call them alcoholics, we called them nervous people. And one of the first big attractions for me you don't even know what you're learning, but one of the things I learned growing up in this system was you never really talk directly about real stuff because you don't want to offend people or tell the truth because that'll offend people. And so I was very good at evasive speech, circumlocution, talking around stuff, and I always thought that was an important part of growing up. So we talked about things, but not directly. And when I started coming to meetings, one of the things that attracted me most was we would talk directly about real stuff. Alcoholism was mentioned, drunk driving was mentioned, time in prison was mentioned, difficulties were talked about, for the most part, simply and directly. We had a couple of drama queens who always burst into tears or threw things, but most of us could talk pretty simply about things, and boy, I found that attractive. I found that a real attractive, and I still like that a lot at meetings, when people can talk about real things pretty directly. So over the years, I've tried to learn how to do that. I hope I do that this morning. I got sober when I was 29 years old. I thought I was the youngest alcoholic in the history of the world that had to get sober. And this was, 1976, I was 29. I got sober during the Republican convention. I wasn't there, but it was on TV, and I was watching a lot of TV at that time. I remember my first day without a drink was the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. I think only he and I remember that day. I think Betty was a little woozy there in the background. But I've always felt wonderful about the Fords, my sober day. One of my friends is a stewardess, and she flies on a major airlines, and she has diabetic and a lot of other things, but she was a bad drunk stewardess, and occasionally she'd push and shove passengers if they got in her way. And at the end of one of her flights, she came off the plane, and they were waiting for her, and they intervened and took her into treatment. So I guess she shoved someone into the bathroom. She goes through treatment and goes back to work. And probably within her first 90 days, she's taking care of the first class cabin, and Mr. Ford is there with the Secret Service agent. And she's 90 days, and she knows who he is. And Mrs. Ford now is quite a important voice in recovery. Anyway, my friend wanders up to him and whispers, "I've got 94 days." And he stood up, he took off his seatbelt, stood up and hugged her and said, "We're so proud of you." You know? So it's really nice when there are good role models out there sometime. What Earth people don't know is that you're supposed to hug people at 94 days, you know? It's like, oh, thank God, we're so glad you're here. And people at 94 days need lots of hugs. So if any of you here are in your early times, I just hope you let people know, because we know. Let's see. I was in the Jesuits when I was I got sober. I still am in the Jesuits. I'm an intervened upon person. I want to make that real clear. I did not wake up one morning and say, "Gee, my life is over. I think I'll reach out for help." That's not what happened to me. I'm a little depressed most of the time, and half Swedish and half Irish. Just in the DNA, neither group is optimistic. We tend to be bleak, and I just figured I was hopeless and doomed, and when I crashed, I hope it didn't last too long or hurt too badly. And it was members of my community who knew something about alcoholism, one of my classmates who just thought I was a liar and a jerk for years, finally added or connected dots and realized there was something going on here, and he talked to his father, who was a Teamster. And his father's best friend was a Teamster in charge of employee assistance programs. And he said, "I think my friend's dying of alcoholism. What do I do?" And they landed on me and intervened on me, and I was put into treatment. It would never have occurred to me to do. Never would have occurred to me. So I'm a successful person who, I mean, it was a successful intervention. I'm still sober. But it took me 5 years to thank the people who intervened on me. Just in case, so you need to know that too. I mean, it's not like, oh, I was intervened on, I'm so glad. When I got intervened on, I remember feeling vast amounts of embarrassment and a lot of shame. And just a lot of this is humiliating. This is a humiliating experience. And after I was sober for a little while, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months, I realized that another thing I was also feeling was rage. And I was a real angry person, but I never knew it because I was so sedated most of the time. I didn't think I was angry. I thought I was right. I go to meetings to hear people's stories, and I The fourth edition of the book came out, and I got sober during the bicentennial year and the year the third edition came out. So I was kind of very used to the third edition. Then they changed it and came out with the fourth edition. And they didn't ask me about adding stories or dropping stories, or I was rather upset. So I got the fourth edition of the book, and I turned in the fourth edition to page 449. For new people, that is the only page in the third edition that some people read. And this is page 449, fourth edition. When I was released from the asylum, I immediately liked it better than the other one. This is a guy I want to have lunch with. I moved to a large city to make a new beginning. My life had become a series of new beginnings. In time, I picked up the drink, got good jobs, and lost them as I had in the past. All the fear and remorse and terrible depression returned tenfold. It still did not register that the drinking might be the cause of all this misery. I sold my blood, I prostituted myself, I drank more. I became homeless and slept in the bus and train terminals. I scrounged cigarette butts off the sidewalks and drank from a common wine bottle with other drunks. I drank my way to the men's municipal shelter and made it my home. I panhandled. By this time, I lived only to drink. I did not bathe or change clothes. I stank. I became thin and ill. I had begun to hear voices and accepted them as death omens. I was frightened, arrogant, enraged, and resentful of man, God, and the universe. There was nothing else to live for, but I was too frightened to die. That's a pretty good first step. You know, there's not a lot breaking his way. And then he writes, "It was at this point that a woman who was a social worker on Skid Row and a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous sat me down in her office and told me her story, how she drank, what happened, and how she got sober. No one had ever done this before. I had been preached to, analyzed, cursed, and counseled, but no one had ever said, 'I identify with what's going on with you. It happened to me, and this is what I did about it.' She got me to my first AA meeting that same evening." Now, in that little paragraph, there are several things that in some meetings would start fistfights. One of which is a professional person taking off the professional hat and coming out as an AA member. That would really upset some groups. Another, this is a woman doing a 12-step call on a man. That will upset some people. I very much like this line that he writes, "I have been preached to, analyzed, cursed, and counseled." Most of us have been, and it's not a very effective way of dealing with people like me. I was at a meeting of the secret fellowship, you know, my home group meeting, a while ago, and we had a young man stand up, and he, our foreman, it's an hour non-smoking, non-clapping meeting, and we had a young man stand, you share for 15 minutes, and then there's a topic, and then the meeting lasts an hour. So this guy stood up, and he said, "I'm not going to tell you my story." He said, "I'm going to tell you," and then he did this, "what the big book says." I had been sober about 25 years at that time, and I got thirsty. I wanted beer. I wanted to crack the beer. I wanted to drain the can, staring him in the eye. That's my reaction to certain tones of voice. And it's why, when I'm in my right mind and dealing with drunks, I try not to preach, analyze, curse, or counsel. What the woman, the social worker, did is she told her story. This is what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And you identify with some things and don't identify with other things. But that's what seems to work. I've been to a couple of meetings where they don't do that. Instead, they chant slogans for an hour. That hasn't helped me very much either. But I really like the stories. So why do people preach, analyze, curse, and counsel at meetings? Now, this is my opinion, and I could be wrong, but I don't think so. It makes the preacher, the analyzer, the curser, or the counselor feel superior. But it sure doesn't help the people in trouble, you know. God. We had one poor guy relapsing, and he came in, and, you know, someone was yelling at him, "What's wrong with you?" And how about alcoholism? You know, how about alcoholism? I really take it very seriously that this is a disease. But I think some of us occasionally think that if you have enough willpower, you'll triumph over the disease. My willpower. You know, what's wrong with you? You just had another heart attack. Shape up. You know, you keep having strokes. We can't tolerate that. You know? I think if anybody's sober, it's a real good news day. And when someone's sick, you don't yell at sick people, and you don't humiliate sick people, and you don't do a lot of awful things to sick people. The response I saw, someone who had relapsed and they came back in, and you know, the shame and the guilt for a lot of these folks is so big, an old-timer came up and just hugged her and said, "I'm so glad you're alive today." And I try to live in that space. I heard someone say a while ago that alcoholism is a lot like dancing with the gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. And this takes a little bit of discussion because we forget that. You know, again, we think it's a moral issue or evolutionary. I mean, we're evolved than they are. That's why I recovered. Early in the evening, you don't know you're in trouble. You just think the gorilla's cute. And you start dancing, you're getting along, you're having a great time. You don't know you're in trouble until you want to sit down and the gorilla doesn't want to. And then a little later on, the gorilla wants to tango and you explain you don't know how and you find out the gorilla doesn't care. You tango. The gorilla kills a lot of us. It's a very deadly thing. When I was about 10 years clean and sober, I started noticing a number of women and men who used to be at meetings and who were no longer at meetings because the gorilla got them, either through overdosing or suicide, drunk or sober, or 10 other reasons. But boy, it's fatal. It's a fatal illness. If you're clean and sober today, it's a pretty good sign that the gorilla has let go. If the gorilla has let go, get out of the cage. And don't go back into the cage even when the gorilla starts humming your song, which it does. And you say, "Gee, I should handle it now. I've learned new steps." Oh, the gorilla's just as strong, just as strong. Now, if you love an alcoholic, you see the one you love dancing with the gorilla, and you panic. And so you break into the cage, and you try to get between the gorilla and the one you love. And then you get your arms and legs ripped off, and you can't imagine how that happened. So there's a program for this, and it's called Al-Anon. And in Al-Anon, they have a couple of basic truths, and one of them is stay out of the cage. They get to dance. Stay out of the cage. And then all my feelings are coming up. That's right, we're going to talk about that. But going into the cage just makes for more casualties, you know? I became a great appreciator of the power and the subtlety and the dangerousness of this disease. I'm a drunk driver. I always want to mention that whenever I share. I drove drunk for years. I had my driver's license when I was 16 years old, and I think I was a drunk driver by the time I was 16 years old in a month. And high school kids drive drunk a lot. Lisa mentioned Norm Alpe last night, seconds and inches. I should have been dead a lot of times. Drunk driver. I'm also a falling down drunk. I thought that I fell down at the end of my drinking, and I did, but I talked to a guy that I knew in high school, and he said I was falling down then, so it was a pretty steady pattern for me, and of course I would fall down and just continue talking because I didn't want people to think anything was wrong. So, also, I'm not a periodic. I was a daily drinker, and I don't understand periodics. I think periodics should talk to periodics because I just don't get it. I'm a daily drinker. I was a snob. I had my pretensions. When I was in college, I got very much involved with Chinese food and martinis. Now, this is controversial, but I think that the martini glass is a geometrically perfect shape. And it can bring tears to my eyes. I was out with some friends of mine, three other sober guys, and we were somewhere, and we ended up at a restaurant, and I was just interested in food, but this was a place for elegant people, male and female, who liked double and triple martinis, and the excitement of the bar in the restaurant is these huge martini glasses, and we four sober guys were there, and these other people were eating their food and doing food things, and I was noticing all these martini glasses carrying martinis being delivered across the room, and I stared at them like a cat watches someone eating a tuna fish sandwich. It just took over my entire head. And I had to say this out loud to my friends. I wanted to go up to one young couple and say, could I just hold your glasses for a few moments? And this is someone with a lot of recovery, so this is not a good sign. And the resolution I made as a result of that is I just don't go back to that restaurant. I mean, some people get sober and they never think of drinking again. I'm very happy for them, but you need to know this. I'm not one of those people. The thought of having a drink runs through what's left of my brain pretty regularly, and it's in the wiring. It's just in the wiring. And when the thought jumps in and it just takes up my whole head, here's the principle I use. Tom, we don't drink today.